Largely, she suspected, because Jace had seen much stranger things in his life, and also because nobody used the word egad anymore. His eyes widened, though. "You did that?" She nodded. "When?" "Just now, in my bedroom, after Simon left." His glance sharpened, but he didn't pursue it. "You used runes. Which ones?" She shook her head, fingering the now blank page. "I don't know. They came into my head and I drew them exactly how I saw them."
"Ones you saw earlier in the gray book?"
"I don't know." She was still shaking her head. "I couldn't tell you."
"And no one ever showed you how to do this? Your mother, for instance?"
"No, I told you before, my mother always told me there was no such thing as magic."
"I bet she did teach you," he interrupted, "and made you forget it afterwards. Magnus did say your memories would come back slowly."
"Maybe."
"Of course."
Jace got to his feet and started to pace. "It's probably against the law to use runes like that unless you've been licensed, but that doesn't matter right now. You think your mother put the cup into a painting? Like you just did with that mug?"
Clary nodded.
"But not one of the paintings in the apartment."
"Where else? A gallery? It could be anywhere."
"Not a painting at all," Clary said. "In a card."
Jace paused, turning toward her.
"A card? You remember that tarot deck of Madame Dorothea's? The one my mother painted for her?"
He nodded.
"And remember when I drew the Ace of Cups? Later, when I saw the statue of the angel, the cup looked familiar to me. It was because I'd seen it before on the ace. My mother painted the mortal cup into Madame Dorothea's tarot deck."
Jace was a step behind her.
"Because she knew that it would be safe with a control, and it was a way she could give it to Dorothea without actually telling her what it was or why she had to keep it hidden. Or even that she had to keep it hidden at all. Dorothea never goes out. She never gave it away.
And your mother was ideally placed to keep an eye on both it and her."
Jace sounded almost impressed.
"Not a bad move."
"I guess so." Clary fought to control the waver in her voice. "I wish she hadn't been so good at hiding it."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, if they'd found it, maybe they would have left her alone. If all they wanted was the cup..."
"They would have killed her, Clary," Jace said. She knew he was telling the truth. "These are the same men who killed my father. The only reason she may still be alive now is that they can't find the cup. Be glad she hid it so well."
"I don't really see what any of this has to do with us," Alex said, looking blearily through his hair.
Jace had woken the rest of the Institute's residents at the crack of dawn and dragged them to the library to, as he said, devise battle strategies. Alec was still in his pajamas, Isabel in a pink peignoir set. Hodge, in his usual sharp tweed suit, was drinking coffee out of a chip blue ceramic mug. Only Jace, bright-eyed despite fading bruises, looked really awake. "I thought the search for the cup was in the hands of the Clave now."
"It's just better if we do it ourselves," said Jace impatiently. "Hodge and I already discussed it, and that's what we decided."
"Well," Isabel tucked a pink-ribboned braid behind her ear, "I'm game."
"I'm not," Alex said. "There are operatives of the Clave in this city right now looking for the cup. Pass the information on to them and let them get it."
"It's not that simple," said Jace.
"It is simple." Alex sat forward, frowning. "This has nothing to do with us and everything to do with your addiction to danger."
Jace shook his head, clearly exasperated. "I don't understand why you're fighting me on this."
"Because he doesn't want you to get hurt," Clary thought, and wondered at his total inability to see what was really going on with Alec. Then again, she'd missed the same thing in Simon. Who was she to talk?
"Look, Dorothea, the owner of the sanctuary, doesn't trust the Clave. Hates them, in fact. She does trust us."
"She trusts me," said Clary.
"I don't know about you. I'm not sure she likes you at all."
Jace ignored her.
"Come on, Alec. It'll be fun.
And think of the glory if we bring the mortal cup back to Idris. Our names will never be forgotten. I don't care about glory, said Alec, his eyes never leaving Jace's face. I care about not doing anything stupid.
In this case, however, Jace is right, said Hodge. If the Clave were to come to the Sanctuary, it would be a disaster. Dorothea would flee with the cup and would probably never be found. No, Jocelyn clearly wanted only one person to be able to find the cup, and that is Clary, and Clary alone.
Then let her go alone, said Alec. Even Isabel gave a little gasp at that. Jace, who had been leaning forward with his hands flat on the desk, stood up straight and looked at Alec coolly. Only Jace, Clary thought, could look cool in pajama bottoms and an old t-shirt, but he pulled it off, probably through sheer force of will.
If you're afraid of a few forsaken, by all means, stay home, he said softly.
Alec went white.
I'm not afraid, he said.
Good, said Jace. Then there's no problem, is there? He looked around the room.
We're all in this together.
Alec mumbled an affirmative while Isabel shook her head in a vigorous nod.
Sure, she said. It sounds fun.
I don't know about fun, said Clary, but I'm in, of course.
But Clary, Hodge said quickly, if you are concerned about the danger, you don't need to go. We can notify the Clave.
No, Clary said, surprising herself. My mom wanted me to find it. Not Valentine and not them either.
It wasn't the monster she was hiding from, Magnus had said. If she really spent her whole life trying to keep Valentine away from this thing, this is the least I can do. Hodge smiled at her.
I think she knew you would say that, he said.
Don't worry anyway, Isabel said. You'll be fine. We can handle a couple of Forsaken. They're crazy, but they're not very smart.
And a lot easier to deal with than demons, said Jace.
Not so tricksy.
Oh, and we're gonna need a car, he added. Preferably a big one.
Why? Said Isabel. We've never needed a car before.
We've never needed to worry about having an immeasurably precious object with us before. I don't want to haul it on the L train, Jace explained.
There's taxis, said Isabel, and rental vans.
Jace shook his head.
I want an environment we control. I don't want to deal with taxi drivers or mundane rental companies when we're doing something this important.
Don't you have a driver's license or a car? Alec asked Clary, looking at her with veiled loathing. I thought all mundanes had those.
Not when they're 15, Clary said crossly. I was supposed to get one this year, but not yet.
Fat lot of use you are.
At least my friends can drive, she shot back. Simon's got a license.
She instantly regretted saying it.
Does he?
Said Jace in an aggravatingly thoughtful tone.
But he hasn't got a car, she added quickly.
So does he drive his parents' car? Jace asked.
Clary sighed, settling back against the desk.
No, usually he drives Eric's van, like to gigs and stuff. Sometimes Eric lets him borrow it for other stuff, like if he has a date.
Jace snorted.
He picks up his dates in a van. No wonder he's such a hit with the ladies.
It's a car, Clary said. You're just mad Simon has something you haven't got.
He has many things I haven't got, said Jace. Like nearsightedness, bad posture, and an appalling lack of coordination.
You know, Clary said, most psychologists agree that hostility is really just sublimated sexual attraction.
Ah, said Jace blithely. That might explain why I so often run into people who seem to dislike me.
I don't dislike you, said Alec quickly.
That is because we share a brotherly affection, said Jace, striding over to the desk.
He took the black telephone and held it out to Clary.
Call him.
Call who? Clary said, stalling for time. Eric? He'd never lend me his car.
Simon, said Jace. Call Simon and ask him if he'll drive us to your house.
Clary made a last effort.
Don't you know any shadow hunters who have cars?
In New York? Jace's grin faded. Look, everyone's in Idris for the Accords, and anyway, they'd insist on coming with us. It's this or nothing. She met his eyes for a moment. There was a challenge in them and something more, as if he were daring her to explain her reluctance. With a scowl, she stalked over to the desk and snatched the telephone out of his hand. She didn't have to think before dialing. Simon's number was as familiar to her as her own. She braced herself to deal with his mother or his sister, but he picked up on the second ring.
Hello?
Simon?
Silence.
Jace was looking at her. Clary squeezed her eyes shut, trying to pretend he wasn't there.
It's me, she said. Clary.
I know who it is, he sounded irritated.
I was asleep, you know.
I know, it's early, I'm sorry. She twirled the phone cord around her finger. I need to ask you for a favor.
There was another silence before he laughed bleakly. You're kidding.
I'm not kidding, she said. We know where the mortal cup is, and we're prepared to go get it. The only thing is, we need a car.
He laughed again.
Sorry, are you telling me that your demon-slaying buddies need to be driven to their next assignation with the forces of darkness by my mom? Actually, I thought you could ask Eric if you could borrow the van. Clary, if you think that if we get the mortal cup, we'll have a way to get my mom back. It's the only reason Valentine hasn't killed her or let her go.
Simon let out a long, whistling breath.
You think it's going to be that easy to make a trade? Clary, I don't know. I don't know either. I just know it's a chance. This thing is powerful, right? In D&D, it's usually better not to mess with powerful objects until you know what they do. I'm not going to mess with it. I'm just going to use it to get my mom back.
That doesn't make any sense, Clary.
This isn't D&D, Simon, she half-screamed. It's not a funny game where the worst thing that happens is you get a bad dice roll. This is my mom we're talking about, and Valentine could be torturing her. He could kill her. I have to do anything I can to get her back, just like I did for you.
Pause.
Maybe you're right.
I don't know, this isn't really my world. Look, where are we driving to exactly, so I can tell Eric?
Don't bring him, she said quickly.
I know, he replied with exaggerated patience. I'm not stupid.
We're driving to my house, it's in my house. There was a short silence, bewilderment this time.
In your house? I thought your house was full of zombies.
Forsaken warriors. They're not zombies. Anyway, Jason and the others can take care of them while I get the cup.
Why do you have to get the cup?
He sounded alarmed.
Because I'm the only one who can, she said. Pick us up at the corner as soon as you can.
He muttered something nearly inaudible, then, fine. She opened her eyes. The world swam before her in a blur of tears.
Thanks, Simon, she said. You're a...
But he had hung up.
It occurs to me, said Hodge, that the dilemmas of power are always the same.
Clary glanced at him sideways.
What do you mean?
She sat on the window seat in the library, Hodge in his chair with Hugo on the armrest. The remains of breakfast, sticky jam, toast crumbs, and smears of butter, clung to a stack of plates on the low table that no one had seemed inclined to clear away. After breakfast, they had scattered to prepare themselves, and Clary had been the first one back. This was hardly surprising, considering that all she had to do was pull on jeans and a shirt and run a brush through her hair, while everyone else had to arm themselves heavily. Having lost Jace's dagger in the hotel, the only remotely supernatural object she had on her was the witchlight stone in her pocket.
I was thinking of your Simon, Hodge said, and of Alec and Jace, among others.
She glanced out the window. It was raining, thick, fat drops splattering against the panes. The sky was an impenetrable gray.
What do they have to do with each other?
Where there is a feeling that is not requited, said Hodge, there is an imbalance of power. It is an imbalance that is easy to exploit, but it is not a wise course. Where there is love, there is often also hate. They can exist side by side.
Simon doesn't hate me.
He might grow to,
over time if he felt you were using him.
Hodge held up a hand.
I know you do not intend to, and in some cases necessity trumps nicety of feelings. But the situation has put me in mind of another. Do you still have that photograph I gave you?
Clary shook her head. Not on me, it's back in my room. I could go get it.
No.
Hodge stroked Hugo's ebony feathers.
When your mother was young, she had a best friend, just as you have Simon. They were as close as siblings. In fact, they were often mistaken for brother and sister. As they grew older, it became clear to everyone around them that he was in love with her, but she never saw it. She always called him a friend.
Clary stared at Hodge. Do you mean Luke?
Yes, said Hodge. Lucian always thought he and Jocelyn would be together. When she met and loved Valentine, he could not bear it. After they were married, he left the circle, disappeared, and let us all think that he was dead.
He never said, never even hinted at anything like that, Clary said. All these years, he could have asked her.
He knew what the answer would be, said
Hodge, looking past her toward the rain-spattered skylight.
Lucian was never the sort of man who would have deluded himself. No, he contented himself with being near her, assuming, perhaps, that over time her feelings might change.
But if he loved her, why did he tell those men he didn't care what happened to her? Why did he refuse to let them tell him where she was?
As I said before, where there is love, there is also hatred, said Hodge. She hurt him badly all those years ago. She turned her back on him. And yet he has played her faithful lapdog ever since, never remonstrating, never accusing, never confronting her with his feelings. Perhaps he saw an opportunity to turn the tables, to hurt her as he'd been hurt.
Luke wouldn't do that. But Clary was remembering his icy tone as he told her not to ask him for favors. She saw the hard look in his eyes as he faced Valentine's men. That wasn't the Luke she'd known, the Luke she'd grown up with. That Luke would never have wanted to punish her mother for not loving him enough or in the right way. But she did love him, Clary said, speaking aloud without realizing it. It just wasn't the same way he loved her. Isn't that enough?
Perhaps he didn't think so.
What will happen after we get the cup? She said. How will we reach Valentine to let him know we have it?
Hugo will find him.
The rain smashed against the windows. Clary shivered. I'm going to get a jacket, she said, slipping off the window seat. She found her green and pink hoodie stuffed down at the bottom of her backpack. When she pulled it out, she heard something crinkle. It was the photograph of the circle, her mother and Valentine. She looked at it for a long moment before slipping it back into the bag. When she returned to the library, the others were all gathered there. Hodge, sitting watchfully on the desk with Hugo on his shoulder, Jace in all black, Isabel with her demon-stomping boots and gold whip, and Alec with a quiver of arrows strapped across his shoulder and a leather bracer sheathing his right arm from wrist to elbow. Everyone but Hodge was covered in freshly applied marks, every inch of bare skin inked with swirling patterns. Jace had his left sleeve pulled up, chin on his shoulder, and was frowning as he scrawled an octagonal mark on the skin of his upper arm. Alec looked over at him. You're messing it up, he said. Let me do that. I'm left-handed, Jace pointed out, but he spoke mildly and held his stele out. Alec looked relieved as he took it, as if he hadn't been sure until now that he was forgiven for his earlier behavior. It's a basic erratze, Jace said as Alec bent his dark head over Jace's arm, carefully tracing the lines of the healing rune. Jace winced as the stele slid over his skin, his eyes half-closing and his fist tightening until the muscles of his left arm stood out like cords.
By the angel, Alec!
I'm trying to be careful, said Alec. He let go of Jace's arm and stepped back to admire his handiwork. There. Jace unclenched his fist, lowering his arm. Thanks. He seemed to sense Clary's presence then, glancing over at her, his gold eyes narrowing. Clary. You look ready. she said as Alec, suddenly flushed, moved away from Jace and busied himself with his arrows.
We are, Jace said. Do you still have that dagger I gave you?
No, I lost it in the Dumour, remember?
That's right.
Jace looked at her pleased. Nearly killed a werewolf with it, I remember. Isabel, who'd been standing by the window, rolled her eyes.
I forgot that's what gets you all hot and bothered, Jace. Girls killing things.
I like anyone killing things, he said equably. Especially me.
Clary glanced anxiously toward the clock on the desk. We should go downstairs. Simon will be here any minute. Hodge stood up from his chair.
He looked very tired, Clary thought, as if he hadn't slept in days.
May the angel watch over you all, he said,
and Hugo rose up from his shoulder into the air, cawing loudly, just as the noon bells began to ring. It was still drizzling when Simon pulled the van up at the corner and honked twice. Clary's heart leaped. Some part of her had been worried that he wasn't going to show up. Jace squinted through the dripping rain. The four of them had taken shelter under a carved stone cornice.
That's the van? It looks like a rotting banana.
This was undeniable. Eric had painted the van a neon shade of yellow, and it was blotched with dings and rust like splotches of decay. Simon honked again. Clary could see him, a blurred shape through the wet windows. She sighed and pulled her hood up to cover her hair.
Let's go.
They splashed through the filthy puddles that had collected on the pavement, Isabel's enormous boots making a satisfying noise every time she put her feet down. Simon, leaving the motor idling, crawled into the back to pull the door aside, revealing seats whose upholstery had half rotted through. Dangerous-looking springs poked through the gaps. Isabel wrinkled her nose.
Is it safe to sit?
Safer than being strapped to the roof, said Simon pleasantly, which is your other option. He nodded a greeting to Jace and Alec, ignoring Clary completely.
Hey.
Hey indeed,
said Jace and lifted the rattling canvas duffel bag that held their weapons. Where can we put these? Simon directed him to the back where the boys usually kept their musical instruments, while Alec and Isabel crawled into the van's interior and perched on the seats. Shotgun, announced Clary as Jace came back around to the side of the van. Alec grabbed for his bow, strapped across his back.
Where?
She means she wants the front seat, said Jace, pushing wet hair out of his eyes.
That's a nice bow, said Simon with a nod toward Alec.
Alec blinked. Rain running off his eyelashes.
Do you know much about archery?
He asked in a tone that suggested that he doubted it. I did archery at camp, said Simon. 6 years running. The response to this was three blank stares and a supportive smile from Clary, which Simon ignored. He glanced up at the lowering sky.
We should go before it starts pouring again.
The front seat of the car was covered in Doritos wrappers and Pop-Tart crumbs. Clary brushed away what she could. Simon started the car before she'd finished, flinging her back against the seat.
Ouch, she said reprovingly.
Sorry. He didn't look at her. Clary could hear the others talking softly in the back amongst themselves, probably discussing battle strategies and the best way to behead a demon without getting ichor on your new leather boots. Though there was nothing separating the front seat from the rest of the van, Clary felt the awkward silence between her and Simon as if they were alone.
So what's with that hey thing?
She asked as Simon maneuvered the car onto the FDR Parkway, the highway that ran alongside the East River.
What hey thing?
He replied, cutting off a black SUV whose occupant, a suited man with a cell phone in his hand, made an obscene gesture at them through the tinted windows.
The hey thing that guys always do. Like when you saw Jason Alec, you said, hey, and they said, hey back.
What's wrong with hello?
She thought she saw a muscle twitch in his cheek. Hello is girly, he informed her. Real men are terse, laconic.
So the more manly you are, the less you say?
Right, Simon nodded. Past him, she could see the humid fog lowering over the East River, shrouding the waterfront in feathery gray mist. The water itself was the color of lead, churned to a whipped cream consistency by the steady wind. That's why when major badasses greet each other in movies, they don't say anything, they just nod. The nod means, I am a badass, and I recognize that you too are a badass. But they don't say anything because they're Wolverine and Magneto and it would mess up their vibe to explain.
I have no idea what you're talking about, said Jace from the back seat.
Good, Clary said, and was rewarded by the smallest of smiles from Simon as he turned the van onto the Manhattan Bridge, heading toward Brooklyn and home. By the time they reached Clary's house, it had finally stopped raining. Threaded beams of sunlight were burning away the remnants of mist, and the puddles on the sidewalk were drying. Jace, Alec, and Isabel made Simon and Clary wait by the van while they went to check, as Jace said, the demonic activity levels. Simon watched as the three shadow hunters headed up the rose-lined walkway to the house.
Demonic activity levels?
Do they have a device that measures whether the demons inside the house are doing power yoga? No, Clary said, pushing her damp hood back so she could enjoy the feel of the sunlight on her draggled hair. The sensor tells them how powerful the demons are, if there are any demons. Simon looked impressed.
That is useful.
She turned to him. Simon, about last night. He held up a hand. We don't have to talk about it. In fact, I'd rather not. Let me just say one thing. She spoke quickly. I know that when you said you love me, what I said back wasn't what you wanted to hear.
True. I'd always hoped that when I finally said, I love you to a girl, she'd say, I know, back, like Leia did to Han in Return of the Jedi.
That is so geeky, Clary said, unable to help herself. He glared at her. Sorry. She said, look, Simon, I... No, he said, you look, Clary. Look at me, and really see me. Can you do that? She looked at him. Looked at the dark eyes flecked with lighter color toward the outside edge of the iris. At the familiar, slightly uneven eyebrows, the long lashes, the dark hair and hesitating smile and graceful musical hands that were all part of Simon, who was a part of her. If she had to tell the truth, would she really say that she'd never known that he loved her? Or just that she'd never known what she would do about it if he did? She sighed. Seeing through glamour is easy. It's people that are hard. We all see what we want to see, he said quietly. Not Jace, she said, unable to help herself, thinking of those clear, impassive eyes. Him more than anyone. She frowned. What are you...
All right, came Jace's voice, interrupting them.
Clary turned hastily. We've checked all four corners of the house. Nothing. Low activity. Probably just the Forsaken, and they might not even bother us unless we try getting into the upstairs apartment. And if they do, said Isabel, her grin as glittering as her whip, we'll be ready for them. Alec dragged the heavy canvas bag out of the back of the van, dropping it on the sidewalk.
Ready to go, he announced. Let's kick some demon butt.
Jace looked at him a little oddly.
You all right?
Fine. Not looking at him, Alec discarded his bow and arrow in favor of a polished wooden feather staff with two glittering blades that appeared at a light touch from his fingers. This is better. Isabel looked at her brother with concern. But the bow... Alec cut her off. I know what I'm doing, Isabel. The bow lay across the back seat, gleaming in the sunlight. Simon reached for it, then drew his hand back as a laughing group of young women pushing strollers headed up the street in the direction of the park. They took no notice of the three heavily armed teenagers crouching by the yellow van.
How come I can see you guys? Simon asked. What happened to that invisibility magic of yours?
You can see us, said Jace, because now you know the truth of what you're looking at.
Yeah, said Simon. I guess I do.
He protested a little when they asked him to stay by the van, but Jace impressed upon him the importance of having a getaway vehicle idling by the curb.
Sunlight's fatal to demons, but it won't hurt the Forsaken. What if they chase us? What if the car gets towed?
The last Clary saw of Simon as she turned to wave from the front porch was his long legs propped up on the dashboard as he sorted through Eric's CD collection. She breathed a sigh of relief. At least Simon was safe. The smell hit her the moment they walked through the front door. It was almost indescribable, like spoiled eggs and maggoty meat and seaweed rotting on a hot beach. Isabel wrinkled her nose and Alec turned greenish, but Jace looked as if he were inhaling rare perfume. "Demons have been here," he announced with cold delight. "Recently, too." Clary looked at him anxiously. "But they're not still..."
"No."
He shook his head. "We would have sensed it, still." He jerked his chin at Dorothea's door, tightly shut without a wisp of light peeking from underneath. "She might have some questions to answer if the Clave hears she's been entertaining demons." "I doubt the Clave will be too pleased about any of this," said Isabel. "On balance, she'll probably come out of it better than we do." "They won't care as long as we get the cup in the end." Alec was glancing around, blue eyes taking in the sizable foyer, the curved staircase leading upstairs, the stains on the walls. "Especially if we slaughter a few forsaken while we do it." Jace shook his head. "They're in the upstairs apartment. My guess is that they won't bother us unless we try to get in." Isabel blew a sticky strand of hair out of her face and frowned at Clary. "What are you waiting for?" Clary glanced involuntarily at Jace, who gave her a sideways smile. "Go ahead," said his eyes. She moved across the foyer toward Dorothea's door, stepping carefully. With the skylight blackened with dirt and the entryway light bulb still out, the only illumination came from Jace's witchlight. The air was hot and close, and the shadows seemed to rise up before her like magically fast-growing plants in a nightmare forest. She reached up to knock on Dorothea's door, once lightly and then again with more force. It swung open, spilling a great wash of golden light into the foyer. Dorothea stood there, massive and imposing in swaths of green and orange. Today, her turban was neon yellow, adorned with a stuffed canary in rickrack trim. Chandelier earrings bobbed against her hair, and her big feet were bare. Clary was surprised. She'd never seen Dorothea barefoot before, or wearing anything other than her faded carpet slippers. Her toenails were a pale and very tasteful shell pink. "Clary!" she exclaimed, and swept Clary into an overwhelming embrace. For a moment, Clary struggled, embroiled in a sea of perfumed flesh, swaths of velvet, and the tasseled ends of Dorothea's shawl. "Good Lord, girl," said the witch, shaking her head until her earrings swung like wind chimes in a storm. "The last time I saw you, you were disappearing through my portal. Where'd you end up?"
"Williamsburg," said Clary, catching her breath. Dorothea's eyebrows shot skyward.
"And they say there's no convenient public transportation in Brooklyn."
She swung the door open and gestured for them to come in. The place looked unchanged from the last time Clary had seen it. There were the same tarot cards and crystal ball scattered on the table. Her fingers itched for the cards, itched to snatch them up and see what might lie hidden inside their slickly painted surfaces. Dorothea sank gratefully into an armchair and regarded the shadow hunters with a stare as beady as the eyes of the stuffed canary on her hat. Scented candles burned in dishes on either side of the table, which did little to dispel the thick stench pervading every inch of the house.
"I take it you haven't located your mother?" she asked Clary.
Clary shook her head.
"No, but I know who took her."
Dorothea's eyes darted past Clary to Alec and Isabel, who were examining the hand of fate on the wall. Jace, looking supremely unconcerned in his role of bodyguard, lounged against a chair arm. Satisfied that none of her belongings were being destroyed, Dorothea returned her gaze to Clary.
"Was it
Valentine?" Clary confirmed.
"Yes."
Dorothea sighed.
"I feared as much."
She settled back against the cushions.
"Do you know what he wants with her?"
"I know she was married to him."
The witch grunted.
"Love gone wrong, the worst."
Jace made a soft, almost inaudible noise at that, a chuckle. Dorothea's ears pricked like a cat's.
What's so funny, boy?
What would you know about it? He said.
Love, I mean.
Dorothea folded her soft white hands in her lap.
More than you might think, she said. Didn't I read your tea leaves, Shadow Hunter? Have you fallen in love with the wrong person yet?
Jace said, Unfortunately, Lady of the Haven, my one true love remains myself. Dorothea roared at that.
At least, she said, you don't have to worry about rejection, Jace Wayland.
Not necessarily. I turn myself down occasionally just to keep it interesting. Dorothea roared again. Clary interrupted her. You must be wondering why we're here, Madam Dorothea.
Dorothea subsided, wiping at her eyes.
Please, she said, feel free to give me my proper title as the boy did. You may call me Lady.
And I assumed, she added, that you came for the pleasure of my company. Was I wrong?
I don't have time for the pleasure of anyone's company. I have to help my mother, and to do that, there's something I need.
And what's that?
It's something called the Mortal Cup, Clary said, and Valentine thought my mother had it. That's why he took her.
Dorothea looked well and truly astonished.
The Cup of the Angel? She said, disbelief coloring her voice. Raziel's cup in which he mixed the blood of angels and the blood of men and gave of this mixture to a man to drink and created the first Shadow Hunter?
That would be the one, said Jace, a little dryness in his tone.
Why on earth would he think she had it? Dorothea demanded. Jocelyn, of all people!
Realization dawned on her face before Clary could speak.
Because she wasn't Jocelyn Frey at all, of course, she said. She was Jocelyn Fairchild, his wife, the one everyone thought had died. She took the cup and fled, didn't she?
Something flickered in the back of the witch's eyes then, but she lowered her lid so quickly that Clary thought she might have imagined it.
So, Dorothea said, do you know what you're gonna do now? Wherever she's hidden it, it can't be easy to find, if you even want it found. Valentine could do terrible things with his hands on that cup.
I want it found, said Clary. We want to... Jace cut her off smoothly.
We know where it is, he said. It's only a matter of retrieving it.
Dorothea's eyes widened.
Well, where is it?
Here. Said Jace, in a tone so smug that Isabel and Alec wandered over from the perusal of the bookcase to see what was going on.
Here? You mean you have it with you?
Not exactly, dear lady, said Jace, who was, Clary felt, enjoying himself in a truly appalling manner.
I meant that you have it.
Dorothea's mouth snapped shut.
That's not funny. She said so sharply that Clary became worried that this was all going terribly wrong.
Why did Jace always have to antagonize everyone?
You do have it, Clary interrupted hurriedly, but not... Dorothea rose from the armchair to her full, magnificent height and glowered down at them.
You are mistaken, she said coldly, both in imagining that I have the cup and in daring to come in here and call me a liar.
Alec's hand went to his feather staff.
Oh, boy, he said under his breath.
Baffled, Clary shook her head.
No, she said quickly. I'm not calling you a liar, I promise. I'm saying that the cup is here, but you never knew it.
Madame Dorothea stared at her. Her eyes, nearly hidden in the folds of her face, were hard as marbles.
Explain yourself, she said.
I'm saying my mother hid it here, said Clary, years ago. She never told you because she didn't want to involve you.
She gave it to you disguised, Jace explained, in the form of a gift.
Dorothea looked at him blankly.
Doesn't she remember? Clary thought, puzzled.
The tarot deck, she said. The cards she painted for you. The witch's gaze went to the cards, lying in their silk wrappings on the table.
The cards?
As her gaze widened, Clary stepped to the table and picked up the deck. They were warm to the touch, almost slippery. Now, as she had not been able to before, she felt the power from the runes painted on their backs pulsing through the tips of her fingers. She found the Ace of Cups by touch and pulled it out, setting the rest of the cards back on the table. "Here it is," she said. They were all looking at her, expectant, perfectly still. Slowly, she turned the card over and looked again at her mother's artwork. The slim, painted hand, its fingers wrapped around the gold stem of the mortal cup. "Jace," she said, "give me your stele." He pressed it, warm and alive feeling, into her palm. She turned the card over and traced over the runes painted on its back, a twist here and a line there, and they meant something entirely different. When she turned the card back over, the picture had subtly changed. The fingers had released their grip on the cup stem, and the hand seemed almost to be offering the cup to her as if to say, "Here, take it." She slid the stele into her pocket. Then, though the painted square was no bigger than her hand, she reached into it as if through a wide gap. Her hand wrapped around the base of the cup, her fingers closed on it, and as she drew her hand back, the cup gripped firmly in it. She thought she heard the smallest of sighs before the card, now blank and empty, turned to ash that sifted away between her fingers to the carpeted floor. 19. Abaddon. Clary wasn't sure what she'd expected. Exclamations of delight, perhaps a smattering of applause. Instead, there was silence, broken only when Jace said, "Somehow, I thought it would be bigger." Clary looked at the cup in her hand. It was the size, perhaps, of an ordinary wine glass, only much heavier. Power thrummed through it like blood through living veins. "It's a perfectly nice size," she said indignantly. "Oh, it's big enough," he said patronizingly, "but somehow I was expecting something, you know." He gestured with his hands, indicating something roughly the size of a house cat. "It's the mortal cup, Jace, not the mortal toilet bowl," said Isabel. "Are we done now? Can we go?" Dorothea had her head cocked to one side, her beady eyes bright and interested. "But it's damaged," she exclaimed. "How did that happen?" "Damaged?" Clary looked at the cup in bewilderment. It looked fine to her. "Here," said the witch, "let me show you." And she took a step toward Clary, holding her long, red-nailed hands out for the cup. Clary, without knowing why, shrank back. Suddenly, Jace was between them, his hand hovering near the sword at his waist. "No offense," he said calmly, "but nobody touches the mortal cup except us." Dorothea looked at him for a moment, and that same strange blankness returned to her eyes. "Now," she said, "let's not be hasty. Valentine would be displeased if anything were to happen to the cup." With a soft snick, the sword at Jace's waist came free. The point hovered just below Dorothea's chin. Jace's look was steady. "I don't know what this is about," he said, "but we're leaving." The old woman's eyes gleamed. "Of course, Shadow Hunter," she said, backing up to the curtained wall. "Would you like to use the portal?" The point of Jace's sword wavered as he stared in momentary confusion. Then Clary saw his jaw tighten. "Don't touch that." Dorothea chuckled, and quick as a flash, she jerked down the curtains hanging along the wall. They fell with the sound of soft collapse. The portal behind them was open. Clary heard Alec behind her suck in his breath. "What is that?" Clary had caught only a glimpse of what was visible through the door. Red, roiling clouds shot through with black lightning and a terrible, dark, rushing shape that hurtled toward them. When Jace shouted for them to get down, he dropped to the floor, yanking Clary down with him. Flat on her stomach on the carpet, she lifted her head in time to see the rushing dark thing strike Madame Dorothea, who screamed, thrusting her arms upward. Rather than knocking her down, the dark thing wrapped her like a shroud, its blackness seeming to seep into her like ink sinking into paper. Her back humped monstrously, her whole shape elongating as she rose and rose into the air, her bulk stretching and reforming. A sharp rattle of objects striking the floor made Clary look down. They were Dorothea's bracelets, twisted and broken. Scattered among the jewels were what looked like small white stones. It took Clary a moment to realize that they were teeth. Beside her, Jace whispered something. It sounded like an exclamation of disbelief. Next to him, Alec, in a choked voice, said, "But you said there wasn't much demonic activity. You said the levels were low."
"They were low," Jace growled.
"Your vision of low must be different from mine," Alec shouted as the thing that had once been Dorothea howled and twisted. It seemed to be spreading, humped and knobbled and grotesquely misshapen. Clary tore her eyes away as Jace stood, pulling her after him. Isabel and Alec stumbled to their feet, gripping their weapons. The hand holding Isabel's whip was trembling slightly.
"Move!"
Jace shoved Clary toward the apartment door. When she tried to look back over her shoulder, she saw only a thickly swirling grayness, like storm clouds, a dark shape at its center. The four of them burst out into the foyer, Isabel in the lead. She raced toward the front door, tried it, and turned with a stricken face. "It's resistant. Must be a spell." Jace swore and fumbled in his jacket. "Where the hell is my stele?" "I have it," Clary said, remembering. As she reached for her pocket, a noise like thunder exploded from the room. The floor heaved under her feet. She stumbled and nearly fell, catching at the banister for support. When she looked up, she saw a gaping new hole in the wall separating the foyer from Dorothea's apartment, lined all around its ragged edges with wood and plaster rubble, through which something was climbing, almost oozing.
"Alec!"
It was Jace shouting. Alec was standing in front of the hole, white-faced and horrified-looking. Swearing, Jace ran up and grabbed him, dragging him back just as the oozing thing pulled itself free of the wall and into the foyer. Clary heard her breath catch. The creature's flesh was livid and bruised-looking. Through the seeping skin, bones protruded. Not new white bones, but bones that looked as if they had been in the earth 1,000 years, black and cracked and filthy. Its fingers were stripped and skeletal. Its thin fleshed arms pocked with dripping black sores through which more yellowing bone was visible. Its face was a skull, its nose and eyes caved in holes. Its taloned fingers brushed the floor. Tangled around its wrists and shoulders were bright swatches of cloth, all that remained of Madame Dorothea's silk scarves and turban. It was at least 9 feet tall. It looked down at the four teenagers with empty eye sockets.
"Give me,"
it said in a voice like the wind blowing trash across empty pavement,
"the mortal cup. Give it to me and I will let you live."
Panicked, Clary stared at the others. Isabel looked as if the sight of the thing had hit her like a punch to the stomach. Alec was motionless. It was Jace, as always, who spoke.
"What are you?" he asked, voice steady, though he looked more rattled than Clary had ever seen him.
The thing inclined its head.
"I am Abaddon. I am the demon of the abyss. Mine are the empty places between the worlds. Mine is the wind and the howling darkness. I am as unlike those mewling things you call demons as an eagle is unlike a fly. You cannot hope to defeat me. Give me the cup or die."
Isabel's whip trembled. "It's a greater demon," she said. "Jace, if we... what about Dorothea?" Clary's voice came shrilly out of her mouth before she could stop it. "What happened to her?"
The demon's empty eyes swung to regard her.
"She was a vessel only," it said. "She opened the portal and I took possession of her. Her death was swift.
its gaze moved to the cup in her hand.
Yours will not be.
It began to move toward her. Jace blocked its way, the glittering sword in one hand, a seraph blade appearing in the other. Alec was watching him, his expression sick with horror.
By the angel, Jace said, looking the demon up and down. I knew greater demons were meant to be ugly, but no one ever warned me about the smell.
Abaddon opened its mouth and hissed. Inside its mouth were two rows of jagged, glass-sharp teeth.
I'm not so sure about this wind and howling darkness business, Jace went on. Smells more like landfill to me.
You're sure you're not from Staten Island?
The demon leaped at him.
Jace whipped his blades up and outward with an almost frightening speed. Both sank into the fleshiest part of the demon, its abdomen. It howled and struck at him, knocking him aside the way a cat might bat aside a kitten. Jace rolled and got to his feet, but Clary could see from the way he was holding his arm that he'd been hurt. That was enough for Isabel. Darting forward, she lashed out at the demon with her whip. It struck the demon's gray hide, and a red wheel appeared, welling blood. Abaddon ignored her, moving toward Jace. With his uninjured hand, Jace drew out a second seraph blade. He whispered to it, and it sprung free, bright and gleaming. He raised it as the demon loomed up before him. He looked impossibly small in front of it, a child dwarfed by a monster. And he was grinning, even as the demon reached for him. Isabel, screaming, lashed out at it, sending blood in a thick spray across the floor. The demon struck, its razored hand lashing down at Jace. Jace staggered back, but he was unharmed. Something had thrown itself between him and the demon, a slim black shadow with a gleaming blade in its hand. Alec. The demon shrieked. Alec's feather staff had pierced its skin. With a snarl, it struck again, bone talons catching Alec a vicious blow that lifted him off his feet and hurled him against the far wall. He struck with a sickening crunch and slid to the floor. Isabel screamed her brother's name. He didn't move. Lowering the whip, she started to run to him. The demon, turning, caught her a backhanded blow that sent her spinning to the ground. Coughing blood, Isabel started to get to her feet. Abaddon knocked her down again, and this time she lay still. The demon moved toward Clary. Jace stood frozen, staring at Alec's crumpled body like someone caught in a dream. Clary screamed as Abaddon neared her. She began to back up the stairs, stumbling on the broken steps. The stele burned against her skin. If only she had a weapon. Anything. Isabel had clawed her way into a sitting position. Pushing her bloody hair back, she screamed at Jace. Clary heard her own name in Isabel's screams and saw Jace, blinking as if slapped awake, spin toward her. He began to run. The demon was close enough now that Clary could see the black sores on its skin, could see that there were things crawling inside them. It reached for her. But Jace was there, knocking Abaddon's hand aside. He flung the seraph blade at the demon. It stuck in the creature's chest, next to the two blades already there. The demon snarled as if the blades were no more than an annoyance.
Shadow Hunter, it snarled. I shall take pleasure in killing you, in hearing your bones crunch as your friends did.
Springing onto the banister, Jace flung himself at Abaddon. The force of the jump knocked the demon backward. It staggered, Jace clinging to its back. He seized a seraph blade out of its chest, sending up a spray of ichor, and brought the blade down again and again into the demon's back, its shoulders running with black fluid. Snarling, Abaddon backed toward the wall. Jace had to drop or be crushed. He fell to the ground, landed lightly, and raised the blade again. But Abaddon was too swift for him. Its hand lashed out, knocking Jace into the stairs. Jace went down, a circle of talons at his throat.
Tell them to give me the cup,
Abaddon snarled, talons hovering just above Jace's skin.
Tell them to give it to me and I will let them live.
Jace swallowed. Clary.
But Clary would never know what he would have said, because at that moment the front door flew open. For a moment, all she saw was brightness. Then, blinking away the fiery afterimage, she saw Simon standing in the open doorway. Simon. She had forgotten he was outside, had almost forgotten he existed. He saw her, crouched on the stairs, and his gaze moved past her and over Abaddon and Jace. He reached back over his shoulder. He was holding Alec's bow, she realized, and the quiver was strapped across his back. He drew an arrow from it, fitted it to the string, and lifted the bow expertly as if he'd done the same thing 100 times before. The arrow sprang free. It made a hot, buzzing sound like a huge bumblebee as it shot over Abaddon's head, plunged toward the roof, and shattered the skylight. Dirty black glass fell like rain, and through the broken pane streamed sunlight, quantities of sunlight, great golden bars of it stabbing downward and flooding the foyer with light. Abaddon screamed and staggered back, shielding its misshapen head with its hands. Jace put a hand to his unharmed throat, staring in disbelief as the demon crumpled, howling to the floor. Clary half expected it to burst into flames, but instead it began to fold in on itself. Its legs collapsed toward its torso, its skull crumpling like burning paper, and within the span of a minute it had vanished entirely, leaving only scorch marks behind. Simon lowered the bow. He was blinking behind his glasses, his mouth slightly open. He looked as astonished as Clary felt. Jace lay on the stairs where the demon had thrown him. He was struggling to sit up as Clary slid down the steps and fell to her knees beside him.
Jace.
I'm all right. He sat up, wiping blood from his mouth. He coughed and spit red.
Alec.
You're Stella, she interrupted, reaching for a pocket. Do you need it to fix yourself? He looked at her. The sunlight pouring through the shattered skylight lit his face. He looked as if he were holding himself back from something with a terrible effort. I'm all right, he said again, and pushed her aside none too gently. He got to his feet, staggered, and nearly fell, the first ungraceful thing she'd ever seen him do. Alec. Clary watched him as he limped across the foyer toward his unconscious friend. Then she zipped the mortal cup into the pocket of her hoodie and got to her feet. Isabel had crawled to her brother's side and was cradling his head in her lap, stroking his hair. His chest rose and fell slowly, but he was breathing. Simon, leaning against the wall watching them, looked utterly drained. Clary squeezed his hand as she passed him.
Thank you, she whispered. That was amazing.
Don't thank me, he said. Thank the archery program at B'nai B'rith summer camp.
Simon, I don't...
Clary! It was Jace calling her. Bring my Stella. Simon let her go reluctantly. She knelt down next to the shadow hunters, the mortal cup thumping heavily against her side. Alec's face was white, freckled with drops of blood, his eyes unnaturally blue. His grip on Jace's wrist left bloody smears.
Did I?
He started, then seemed to see Clary as if for the first time. There was something in his look she hadn't expected. Triumph.
Did I kill it?
Jace's face twisted painfully.
You?
Yes, Clary said. It's dead. Alec looked at her and laughed. Blood bubbled up in his mouth. Jace pulled his wrist free, touched his fingers to either side of Alec's face.
Don't, he said. Hold still. Just hold still.
Alec closed his eyes.
Do what you have to do, he whispered.
Isabel held her stele out to Jace.
Take it.
He nodded and drew the tip of the stele down the front of Alec's shirt. The material parted as if he'd sliced it with a knife. Isabel watched him through frantic eyes as he yanked the shirt open, leaving Alec's chest bare. His skin was very white, marked here and there with old translucent scars. There were other injuries there, too, a darkening lattice of claw marks, each hole red and oozing. Jaw set, Jace set the stele to Alec's skin, moving it back and forth with the ease of long practice. But there was something wrong.
Even as he drew the healing marks, they seemed to vanish as if he were writing on water. Jace threw the stele aside.
Damn it!
Isabel's voice was shrill.
What's going on?
It cut him with his talons, Jace said. There's demon poison in him. The marks can't work. He touched Alec's face again gently.
Alec, he said. Can you hear me?
Alec didn't move. The shadows under his eyes looked blue and as dark as bruises. If it weren't for his breathing, Clary would have thought he was already dead. Isabel bent her head, her hair covering Alec's face. Her arms were around him.
Maybe, she whispered, we could
take him to the hospital? It was Simon standing over them, the bow dangling in his hand. I'll help you carry him to the van. There's Methodist down on 7th Avenue.
No hospitals, said Isabel. We need to get him to the Institute.
But they won't know how to treat him in a hospital, said Jace. He's been cut by a greater demon. No mundane doctor would know how to heal those wounds. Simon nodded.
All right, let's get him in the car.
In a stroke of good luck, the van hadn't been towed. Isabel draped a dirty blanket across the back seat, and they laid Alec down across it, his head on Isabel's lap. Jace crouched down on the floor beside his friend. His shirt was stained dark across the sleeves and chest with blood, demon and human. When he looked at Simon, Clary saw that all the gold seemed washed out of his eyes by something she had never seen in them before. Panic.
Drive fast, mundane, he said. Drive like hell was following you.
Simon drove. They careened down Flatbush and rocketed onto the bridge, keeping pace with the Q train as it roared over the blue water. The sun was painfully bright in Clary's eyes, striking hot sparks off the river. She clutched at her seat as Simon took the curving ramp off the bridge at 50 miles an hour. She thought about the awful things she'd said to Alec, the way he'd thrown himself at Abaddon, the look of triumph on his face. When she turned her head now, she saw Jace kneeling next to his friend as blood seeped through the blanket. She thought of the little boy with the dead falcon. To love is to destroy. Clary turned back around, a hard lump lodged in the back of her throat. Isabel was visible in the badly angled rearview mirror, wrapping the blanket around Alec's throat. She looked up and met Clary's eyes.
How much farther?
Maybe 10 minutes. Simon's driving as fast as he can.
I know, Isabel said. Simon, what you did, that was incredible. You moved so fast, I wouldn't have thought a mundane could have thought of something like that.
Simon didn't seem fazed by praise from such an unexpected quarter. His eyes were on the road.
You mean shooting out the skylight? It hit me after you guys went inside. I was thinking about the skylight and how you'd said demons couldn't stand direct sun. So, actually, it took me a while to act on it.
Don't feel bad, he added. You can't even see that skylight unless you know it's there.
I knew it was there, Clary thought. I should have acted on it. Even if I didn't have a bow and arrow like Simon, I could have thrown something at it or told Jace about it.
She felt stupid and useless and thick, as though her head were full of cotton. The truth was that she'd been frightened, too frightened to think straight. She felt a bright surge of shame that burst behind her eyelids like a small sun. Jace spoke then.
It was well done, he said.
Simon's eyes narrowed.
So, if you don't mind telling me, that thing, the demon, where did it come from?
It was Madame Dorothea, said Clary. I mean, it was sort of her.
She was never exactly a pinup, but I don't remember her looking that bad.
I think she was possessed, said Clary slowly, trying to piece it together in her own mind. She wanted me to give her the cup. Then she opened the portal.
It was clever, said Jace. The demon possessed her, then hid the majority of its ethereal form just outside the portal, where the sensor wouldn't register it. So we went in expecting to fight a few forsaken. Instead, we found ourselves facing a greater demon, Abaddon, one of the ancients, the Lord of the Fallen.
Well, it looks like the Fallen will just have to learn to get along without him from now on, said Simon, turning onto the street.
He's not dead, Isabel said. Hardly anyone's ever killed a greater demon. You have to kill them in their physical and ethereal forms before they'll die. We just scared him off.
Oh. Simon looked disappointed.
What about Madame Dorothea? Will she be all right now that...
He broke off because Alec had begun to choke, his breath rattling in his chest. Jay swore under his breath with vicious precision.
Why aren't we there yet?
We are here. I just don't want to crash into a wall. As Simon pulled up carefully at the corner, Clary saw that the door of the Institute was open, Hodge standing framed in the arch. The van jerked to a halt, and Jace leaped out, reaching back to lift Alec as if he weighed no more than a child. Isabel followed him up the walk, holding her brother's bloody feather staff. The Institute door slammed shut behind them. Tiredness washing over her, Clary looked at Simon.
I'm sorry. I don't know how you're going to explain all the blood to Eric.
Screw Eric, he said with conviction.
Are you all right?
Not a scratch.
Everyone else got hurt, but not me.
It's their job, Clary, he said gently. Fighting demons, it's what they do, not what you do.
What do I do, Simon? She asked, searching his face for an answer. What do I do?
Well, you got the cup, he said, didn't you?
She nodded and tapped her pocket. Yes.
He looked relieved.
I almost didn't want to ask, he said.
That's good, right?
It is, she said. She thought of her mother and her hand tightened on the cup.
I know it is.
This ends Disc 9. City of Bones, Disc 10.
Church met her at the top of the stairs, yowling like a foghorn, and led her to the infirmary. The double doors were open, and through them she could see Alec's still figure, motionless on one of the white beds. Hodge was bent over him. Isabel, beside the older man, held a silver tray in her hands. Jace was not with them. He was not with them because he was standing outside the infirmary, leaning against the wall, his bare, bloody hands curled at his sides. When Clary stopped in front of him, his lids flew open, and she saw that the pupils of his eyes were dilated, all the gold swallowed up in black.
How is he? She asked as gently as she could.
He's lost a lot of blood. Demon poisonings are common, but since it was a greater demon, Hodge isn't sure if the antidotes he usually employs will be viable. She reached to touch his arm.
Jace.
He flinched away. Don't. She sucked in her breath.
I never would have wanted anything to happen to Alec. I'm so sorry.
He looked at her as if seeing her there for the first time. It's not your fault, he said. It's mine.
Yours? Jace, no, it isn't.
Oh, but it is, he said, his voice as fragile as a sliver of ice. Mea culpa. Mea maxima culpa.
What does that mean?
My fault, he said. My own fault. My most grievous fault. It's Latin. He brushed a lock of her hair back from her forehead absently, as if unaware he was doing it. Part of the mass.
I thought you didn't believe in religion.
I may not believe in sin, he said, but I do feel guilt. We shadow hunters live by a code, and that code isn't flexible. Honor, fault, penance, those are real to us, and they have nothing to do with religion, and everything to do with who we are. This is who I am, Clary, he said desperately. I am one of the Clave. It's in my blood and bones. So tell me, if you're so sure this wasn't my fault, why is it that the first thought in my mind when I saw Abaddon wasn't for my fellow warriors, but for you? His other hand came up. He was holding her face, prisoned between his palms. I know. I knew. Alec wasn't acting like himself. I knew something was wrong. But all I could think about was you. He bent his head forward so their foreheads touched.
She could feel his breath stir her eyelashes. She closed her eyes, letting the nearness of him wash over her like a tide. "If he dies, it will be like I killed him," he said. "I let my father die, and now I've killed the only brother I ever had."
"That's not true," she whispered.
"Yes, it is."
They were close enough to kiss, and still he held her tightly as if nothing could reassure him that she was real.
"Clary," he said, "what's happening to me?"
She searched her mind for an answer and heard someone clear his throat. She opened her eyes. Hodge stood by the infirmary door, his neat suit stained with patches of rust.
"I have done what I can. He is sedated, not in pain, but..."
He shook his head.
"I must contact the Silent Brothers. This is beyond my abilities."
Jace drew slowly away from Clary. "How long will it take them to get here?"
"I don't know."
Hodge started down the corridor, shaking his head.
"I'll send Hugo immediately, but the brothers come at their own discretion."
"But for this..." Even Jace was scrambling to keep up with Hodge's long strides. Clary had fallen hopelessly behind the two of them and had to strain her ears to hear what he was saying. "He might die otherwise."
"He might," was all Hodge said in response.
The library was dark and smelled like rain. One of the windows had been left open, and a puddle of water had collected under the curtains. Hugo chirruped and bounced on his perch as Hodge strode over to him, pausing only to light the lamp on his desk.
"It is a pity," Hodge said, reaching for paper and a fountain pen, "that you did not retrieve the cup. It would, I think, bring some comfort to Alec and certainly to his..."
"But I did retrieve the cup," said Clary, amazed. "Didn't you tell him, Jace?" Jace was blinking, though whether it was because of surprise or the sudden light, Clary couldn't tell. "There wasn't time. I was bringing Alec upstairs." Hodge had gone very still, the pen motionless between his fingers.
"You have the cup?"
"Yes." Clary drew the cup out of her pocket. It was still cold, as if contact with her body could not warm the metal. The rubies winked like red eyes. "I have it here." The pen slipped from Hodge's hand entirely and struck the floor at his feet. The lamplight, thrown upward, was not kind to his ravaged face. It showed every etched line of harshness and worry and despair.
"That is the angel's cup."
"The one," said Jace. "It was..."
"Never mind that now," said Hodge.
He set the paper down on the desk and moved toward Jace, catching his student by the shoulders.
"Jace Wayland, do you know what you've done?"
Jace looked up at Hodge, surprised. Clary noted the contrast. The ravaged face of the older man and the boy's unlined one, the pale locks of hair falling into Jace's eyes, making him look even younger.
"I'm not sure what you mean," Jace said.
Hodge's breath hissed out through his teeth.
"You look so much like him."
"Like who?" said Jace in astonishment. He had clearly never heard Hodge talk this way before.
"Like your father," Hodge said, and raised his eyes to where Hugo, black wings stirring the humid air, hovered just overhead.
Hodge narrowed his eyes.
"Hugin," he said, and with an unearthly caw, the bird dived straight for Clary's face, claws outstretched.
Clary heard Jace shout, and the world was whirling feathers and slashing beak and claws. Bright pain bloomed along her cheek, and she shrieked, instinctively throwing her hands up to cover her face. She felt the mortal cup yanked from her grasp. "No!" she cried, grabbing for it. An agonizing pain shot up her arm. Her legs seemed to go out from under her. She slipped and fell, striking her knees painfully against the hard floor. Claws raked her forehead.
"That's enough, Hugo," said Hodge in his quiet voice.
Obediently, the bird spun away from Clary. Gagging, she blinked blood out of her eyes. Her face felt shredded. Hodge had not moved. He stood where he was, holding the mortal cup. Hugo was circling him in wide, agitated rounds, cawing softly.
and Jace. Jace lay on the floor at Hodge's feet, very still, as if he had fallen suddenly asleep. All other thoughts were driven from her mind.
Jace!
Speaking hurt. The pain in her cheek was startling, and she could taste blood in her mouth. Jace didn't move.
He's not hurt, said Hodge.
Clary started to her feet, meaning to fling herself at him, then reeled back as she struck something invisible, but as hard and strong as glass. Infuriated, she struck against the air with her fist.
Hodge! She shouted.
She kicked out, nearly bruising her feet on the same invisible wall.
Don't be stupid. When the clay finds out what you've done...
I'll be long gone by then, he said, kneeling over Jace.
But... A shock ran through her. A jolt of electric realization. You never sent a message to the clave, did you? That's why you were so weird when I asked you about it. You wanted the cup for yourself.
Not, said Hodge, for myself.
Clary's throat was dry as dust.
You work for Valentine, she whispered.
I do not work for Valentine, said Hodge.
He lifted Jace's hand and drew something from it. It was the engraved ring Jace always wore. Hodge slipped it onto his own finger.
But I am Valentine's man, it is true.
With a swift movement, he twisted the ring 3 times around his finger. For a moment, nothing happened. Then Clary heard the sound of a door opening and turned instinctively to see who was coming into the library. When she turned back, she saw that the air beside Hodge was shimmering, like the surface of a lake seen from a distance. The shimmering wall of air parted like a silver curtain, and then a tall man was standing next to Hodge, as if he had coalesced out of humid air.
Starkweather, he said. You have the cup?
Hodge raised the cup in his hands but said nothing. He appeared paralyzed, whether with fear or astonishment it was impossible to tell. He had always seemed tall to Clary, but now he looked hunched and small.
My Lord Valentine, he said finally, I had not expected you so quickly.
Valentine. He bore little resemblance to the handsome boy in the photograph, though his eyes were still black. His face was not what she had expected. It was a restrained, closed, interior face, the face of a priest with sorrowful eyes. Creeping out beneath the black cuffs of his tailored suit were the ridged, white scars that spoke of years of the stele.
I told you I would come to you through a portal, he said.
His voice was resonant and strangely familiar.
Didn't you believe me? Yes, it's just... I thought you'd send Pangborn or Blackwell, not come yourself.
You think I would send them to collect the cup?
I am not a fool. I know its lure.
Valentine held out his hand, and Clary saw, gleaming on his finger, a ring that was the twin of Jace's.
Give it to me.
But Hodge held the cup fast.
I want what you promised me first.
First? You don't trust me, Starkweather? Valentine smiled, a smile not without humor in it.
I'll do as you asked. A bargain is a bargain. Though I must say I was astonished to get your message. I wouldn't have thought you'd mind a life of hidden contemplation, so to speak. You never were much for the battlefield. You don't know what it's like, Hodge said, letting out his breath with a hissing gasp. Being afraid all the time.
That's true. I don't. Valentine's voice was as sorrowful as his eyes, as if he pitied Hodge. But there was dislike in his eyes, too, a trace of scorn.
If you did not intend to give the cup to me, he said, you should not have summoned me here.
Hodge's face worked.
It is not easy to betray what you believe in, those who trust you.
Do you mean the Lightwoods or their children?
Both, said Hodge.
Ah, the Lightwoods. Valentine reached out and with a hand caressed the brass globe that stood on the desk, his long fingers tracing the outlines of continents and seas.
But what do you owe them, really?
Yours is the punishment that should have been theirs. If they had not had such high connections in the clave, they would have been cursed along with you. As it is, they are free to come and go, to walk in the sunlight like ordinary men. They are free to go home. His voice, as he said home, thrilled with all the meaning of the word. His finger had stopped moving over the globe. Clary was sure he was touching the place where Idris would be. Hodge's eyes darted away.
They did what anyone would do.
You would not have done it. I would not have done it. To let a friend suffer in my place? And surely it must engender some bitterness in you, Starkweather, to know that they so easily left this fate to you. Hodge's shoulders shook.
But it is not the children's fault. They have done nothing.
I never knew you to be so fond of children, Starkweather, Valentine said as if the idea entertained him. The breath rattled in Hodge's chest.
Jace,
you will not speak of Jace. For the first time, Valentine sounded angry. He glanced at the still figure on the floor. He is bleeding, he observed. Why? Hodge held the cup against his heart. His knuckles were white.
It's not his blood. He's unconscious, but not injured.
Valentine raised his head with a pleasant smile. I wonder, he said, what he will think of you when he wakes. Betrayal is never pretty, but to betray a child, that's a double betrayal, don't you think?
You won't hurt him, whispered Hodge. You swore you wouldn't hurt him.
I never did that, said Valentine. Come now. He moved away from the desk toward Hodge, who flinched away like a small trapped animal. Clary could see his misery. And what would you do if I said I did plan to hurt him? Would you fight me? Keep the cup from me? Even if you could kill me, the clave would never lift your curse. You'll hide here till you die, terrified to do so much as open a window too widely. What wouldn't you trade away? Not to be afraid any longer. What wouldn't you give up to go home again? Clary tore her eyes away. She could no longer bear the look on Hodge's face. In a choked voice, he said,
Tell me you won't hurt him, and I'll give it to you.
No, said Valentine even more softly. You'll give it to me anyway. And he reached out his hand. Hodge closed his eyes. For a moment, his face was the face of one of the marble angels beneath the desk, pained and grave and crushed beneath a terrible weight. Then he swore pathetically under his breath and held the mortal cup out for Valentine to take, though his hand shook like a leaf in a high wind. Thank you, said Valentine. He took the cup and eyed it thoughtfully. I do believe you dented the rim. Hodge said nothing. His face was gray. Valentine bent down and gathered up Jace. As he lifted him up lightly, Clary saw the impeccably cut jacket tighten over his arms and back, and she realized that he was a deceptively massive man, with a torso like the trunk of an oak tree. Jace, limp in his arms, looked like a child by comparison. He'll be with his father soon, said Valentine, looking down at Jace's white face. Where he belongs. Hodge flinched. Valentine turned away from him and walked back toward the shimmering curtain of air that he had come through. He must have left the portal door open behind him, Clary realized. Looking at it was like looking at sunlight bouncing off the surface of a mirror. Hodge reached out an imploring hand.
Wait, he cried. What of your promise to me? You swore to end my curse.
That is true, said Valentine. He paused and looked hard at Hodge, who gasped and stepped back, his hand flying to his chest as if something had struck him in the heart. Black fluid seeped out around his splayed fingers and trickled to the floor. Hodge lifted his scarred face to Valentine.
Is it done? He asked wildly. The curse, is it lifted?
Yes, said Valentine, and may your bought freedom bring you joy. And with that, he stepped through the curtain of glowing air.
For a moment, he himself seemed to shimmer as if he stood underwater. Then he vanished, taking Jace with him.
20. In Rat's Alley.
Hodge, gasping, stared after him, his fists clenching and unclenching at his sides. His left hand was gloved with the wet, dark fluid that had seeped from his chest. The look on his face was a mixture of exultation and self-loathing. Hodge! Clary slammed her hand into the invisible wall between them. Pain shot up her arm, but it was nothing compared to the searing pain inside her chest. She felt as if her heart were going to slam its way out of her ribcage. Jace, Jace, Jace. The words echoed in her mind, wanting to be screamed out loud. She bit them back.
Hodge, let me out!
Hodge turned, shaking his head.
I can't, he said, using his immaculately folded handkerchief to rub at his stained hand. He sounded genuinely regretful. You'll only try to kill me.
I won't, she said. I promise.
But you were not raised a shadow hunter, he said, and your promises mean nothing.
The edge of his handkerchief was smoking now, as if he'd dipped it in acid, and his hand was no less blackened. Frowning, he abandoned the project.
But Hodge, she said desperately, didn't you hear him? He's going to kill Jace.
He didn't say that.
Hodge was at the desk now, opening a drawer, taking out a piece of paper. He drew a pen from his pocket, tapping it sharply against the edge of the desk to make the ink flow. Clary stared at him.
Was he writing a letter?
Hodge, she said carefully. Valentine said Jace would be with his father soon. Jace's father is dead. What else could he have meant?
Hodge didn't look up from the paper he was scribbling on. It's complicated. You wouldn't understand.
I understand enough.
Her bitterness felt like it might burn through her tongue. I understand that Jace trusted you, and you traded him away to a man who hated his father and probably hates Jace too, just because you're too cowardly to live with the curse you deserved.
Hodge's head jerked up. Is that what you think?
It's what I know.
He'd laid his pen down, shaking his head. He looked tired and so old, so much older than Valentine had, though they were the same age.
You only know bits and fragments, Clary, and you're better off that way.
He folded the paper he'd been writing on into a neat square and tossed it into the fire, which flared up a bright, acidic green before subsiding.
What are you doing? Clary demanded.
Sending a message.
Hodge turned away from the fire. He was standing close to her, separated only by the invisible wall. She pressed her fingers against it, wishing she could dig them into his eyes, though they were as sad as Valentine's had been angry.
You are young, he said.
The past is nothing to you, not even another country as it is to the old, or a nightmare as it is to the guilty.
The Clave laid this curse on me because I aided Valentine. But I was hardly the only member of the Circle to serve him. Were the Lightwoods not as guilty as I was? Were not the Waylands? Yet I was the only one cursed to live out my life without being able to set so much as a foot outdoors, not so much as a hand through the window.
That's not my fault, said Clary. It's not Jace's fault. Why punish him for what the Clave did? I can understand giving Valentine the cup, but Jace? He'll kill Jace, just like he killed Jace's father.
Valentine, said Hodge, did not kill Jace's father.
A sob broke free from Clary's chest. I don't believe you. All you do is tell lies. Everything you've ever said was a lie.
Ah, he said. The moral absolutism of the young, which allows for no concessions. Can't you see, Clary, that in my own way I'm trying to be a good man?
She shook her head. It doesn't work that way. The good things you do don't cancel out the bad ones. But, she bit her lip, if you told me where Valentine was...
No.
He breathed the word.
It is said that the Nephilim are the children of men and angels. All that this angelic heritage has given to us is a longer distance to fall.
He touched the invisible surface of the wall with his fingertips.
You were not raised as one of us. You have no part of this life of scars and killing. You can still get away. Leave the Institute, Clary, as soon as you can. Leave and never come back.
She shook her head.
I can't, she said.
I can't do that.
Then you have my condolences, he said, and walked out of the room.
The door closed behind Hodge, leaving Clary in silence. There was only her own harsh breathing and the scrabble of her fingertips against the ungiving, transparent barrier between her and the door. She did exactly what she'd told herself she wouldn't do and flung herself against it again and again until she was exhausted and her sides ached. Then she sank to the floor and tried not to cry. Somewhere on the other side of this barrier, Alec was dying while Isabel waited for Hodge to come and save him. Somewhere beyond this room, Jace was being shaken roughly awake by Valentine. Somewhere, her mother's chances were ebbing away moment by moment, second by second. And she was trapped here, as useless and helpless as the child she was. She sat bolt upright then, remembering the moment at Madame Dorothea's when Jace had pressed the stele into her hand. Had she ever given it back to him? Holding her breath, she felt in her left jacket pocket. It was empty. Slowly, her hand crept into the right pocket, her sweaty fingers picking up lint and then skidding across something hard, smooth, and round. The stele. She bounded to her feet, her heart pounding, and felt with her left hand for the invisible wall. Finding it, she braced herself, inching the tip of the stele forward with her other hand until it rested against the smooth, level air. Already, an image was forming in her mind, like a fish rising up through cloudy water, the pattern of its scales growing clearer and clearer as it neared the surface. Slowly at first, and then more confidently, she moved the stele across the wall, leaving searingly bright, ash-white lines hovering in the air before her. She felt when the rune was done and lowered her hand, breathing hard. For a moment, everything was motionless and silent, and the rune hung like glowing neon, burning her eyes. Then came a sound like the loudest shattering she had ever heard, as if she were standing under a waterfall of stones, listening to them crash to the ground all around her. The rune she had drawn turned black and sifted away like ash. The floor trembled under her feet. Then it was over, and she knew without a doubt that she was free. Still holding the stele, she raced to the window and pushed the curtain aside. Twilight was falling, and the streets below her were bathed in a reddish-purple glow. She caught a glimpse of Hodge crossing a street, his gray head bobbing above the crowd. She dashed out of the library and down the stairs, pausing only to shove the stele back into her jacket pocket. She took the stairs running and hit the street with a stitch already forming in her side. People walking their dogs in the humid twilight jumped aside as she barreled down the walkway along the East River. She caught sight of herself in the darkened window of an apartment building as she careened around a corner. Her sweaty hair was plastered to her forehead, her face crusted with dried blood. She reached the intersection where she had seen Hodge. For a moment, she thought she'd lost him. She darted through the crowd near the subway entrance, shouldering people aside, using her knees and elbows as weapons. Sweaty and bruised, Clary pulled free of the crowd just in time to see a flash of tweed suit disappear around the corner of a narrow service alley between two buildings. She wriggled around a dumpster and into the mouth of the alley. The back of her throat felt like it was burning every time she breathed. Though it had been twilight on the street, here in the alley, it was as dark as nightfall. She could just see Hodge, standing at the far end of the alley, where it dead-ended into the back of a fast-food restaurant. Restaurant trash was piled outside, heaping bags of food, dirty paper plates, and plastic cutlery that crunched unpleasantly under his boots as he turned to look at her. She remembered a poem she'd read in English class. "I think we are in Rat's Alley,
where the dead men lost their bones.
You followed me, he said. You shouldn't have.
I'll leave you alone if you just tell me where Valentine is.
I can't do that, he said. He'll know I told you, and my freedom will be as short as my life.
It will be anyway when the clay finds out that you gave the mortal cup to Valentine, Clary pointed out. After tricking us into finding it for you? How can you live with yourself knowing what he plans to do with it? He cut her off with a short laugh.
I fear Valentine more than the clave, and so would you if you were wise, he said. He would have found the cup eventually, whether I helped him or not.
And you don't care that he's going to use it to kill children? A spasm crossed his face as he took a step forward. She saw something shine in his hand.
Does it all really matter to you this much?
I told you before, she said. I can't just walk away.
That's too bad, he said,
and she saw him raise his arm and remembered suddenly Jace saying that Hodge's weapon had been the chakram, the flying disc. She ducked even before she saw the bright circle of metal spin singing toward her head. It passed, humming, inches from her face and embedded itself in the metal fire escape on her left. She looked up. Hodge was gazing at her, the second metal disc held lightly in his right hand.
You can still run, he said.
Instinctively, she raised her hands, though logic told her the chakram would just slice them into pieces. Hodge! Something hurtled in front of her, something big, gray-black, and alive. She heard Hodge shout in horror. Stumbling backward, Clary saw the thing more clearly as it paced between her and Hodge. It was a wolf, 6 feet in length, with a jet-black coat shot through with a single stripe of gray. Hodge, the metal disc gripped in his hand, was white as a bone.
You,
he breathed, and with a sense of distant astonishment, Clary realized he was talking to the wolf.
I thought that you had fled.
The wolf's lips drew back from its teeth, and she saw its lolling red tongue. There was hatred in its eyes as it looked at Hodge, a pure and human hatred.
Did you come for me or for the girl? Said Hodge.
Sweat streamed from his temples, but his hand was steady. The wolf paced toward him, growling low in its throat.
There's still time, said Hodge. Valentine would take you back.
With a howl, the wolf sprang. Hodge cried out again. Then there was a flash of silver and a sickening noise as the chakram embedded itself in the wolf's side. The wolf reared back on its hind legs, and Clary saw the disc's edge jutting from the wolf's fur, blood streaming just as it struck Hodge. Hodge screamed once as he went down, the wolf's jaws clamping shut over his shoulder. Blood flew into the air like the spray of paint from a broken can, splattering the cement wall with red. The wolf lifted its head from the tutor's limp body and turned its gray, lupine gaze on Clary, teeth dripping scarlet. She didn't scream. There was no air in her lungs that she could have dragged up to make a sound. She scrambled to her feet and ran for the mouth of the alley and the familiar neon lights of the street, ran for the safety of the real world. She could hear the wolf growling behind her, feel its hot breath on the bare backs of her legs. She put on one last burst of speed, flinging herself toward the street. The wolf's jaws closed on her leg, jerking her backward. Just before her head struck the hard pavement, plunging her into blackness, she discovered that she did have enough air to scream after all. The sound of dripping water woke her. Slowly, Clary peeled her eyes open. There wasn't much to see. She lay on a wide cot that had been placed on the floor of a small, dingy-walled room. There was a rickety table propped against one wall. On it was a cheap-looking brass candle holder sporting a fat red candle that cast the only light in the room. The ceiling was cracked and damp, wetness seeping down through the fissures in the stone. Clary felt a vague sense that something was missing from the room, but this concern was overwhelmed by the strong smell of wet dog. She sat up and immediately wished she hadn't. Hot pain drove through her head like a spike, followed by a racking wave of nausea.
If there had been anything in her stomach, she would have thrown it up. A mirror hung over the cot, dangling from a nail driven between two stones. She glanced in it and was appalled. No wonder her face hurt. Long, parallel scratches ran from the corner of her right eye down to the edge of her mouth. Her right cheek was crusted with blood, and blood was smeared on her neck and all down the front of her shirt and jacket. In a sudden panic, she grabbed for her pocket, then relaxed. The stele was still there. It was then that she realized what was odd about the room. One wall of it was bars. Thick, iron, floor-to-ceiling bars. She was in a jail cell. Veins surging with adrenaline, Clary staggered to her feet. A wave of dizziness washed over her, and she caught at the table to steady herself. "I will not faint," she told herself grimly. Then she heard the footsteps. Someone was coming down the hallway outside the cell. Clary backed up against the table. It was a man. He was carrying a lamp, its light brighter than the candle, which made her blink and turned him into a backlit shadow. She saw height, square shoulders, ragged hair. It was only when he pushed the door of the cell open and came inside that she realized who he was. He looked the same. Worn jeans, denim shirt, work boots, same uneven hair, same glasses pushed down to the bridge of his nose. The scars she'd noticed along the side of his throat last time she'd seen him were healing patches of shiny skin now. Luke. It was all too much for Clary. Exhaustion, lack of sleep and food, terror and blood loss caught up with her in a rushing wave. She felt her knees buckle as she slid toward the ground. In seconds, Luke was across the room. He moved so fast, she didn't have time to hit the floor before he caught her, swinging her up the way he'd done when she was a little girl. He set her down on the cot and stepped back, eyes anxious. "Clary," he said, reaching for her. "Are you all right?" She flinched away, throwing up her hands to ward him off. "Don't touch me." An expression of profound hurt crossed his face. Wearily, he drew a hand across his forehead. "I guess I deserve that." "Yeah, you do." The look on his face was troubled. "I don't expect you to trust me." "That's good, because I don't. Clary." He began to pace the length of the cell. "What I did, I don't expect you to understand. I know you feel that I abandoned you." "You did abandon me," she said. "You told me never to call you again. You never cared about me. You never cared about my mother. You lied about everything." "Not," he said, "about everything." "So your name really is Luke Garraway?" His shoulders drooped perceptibly. "No," he said, then glanced down. A dark red patch was spreading across the front of his blue denim shirt. Clary sat up straight. "Is that blood?" she demanded. She forgot for a moment to be furious. "Yes," said Luke, his hand against his side. "The wound must have torn open when I lifted you." "What wound?" Clary couldn't help asking. He said with deliberation, "Hodge's discs are still sharp, though his throwing arm is not what it once was. I think you may have nicked a rib." "Hodge," Clary said. "When did you..." He looked at her, not saying anything, and she remembered suddenly the wolf in the alley, all black except for that one gray streak down its side, and she remembered the disc hitting it, and she realized. "You're a werewolf." He took his hand away from his shirt. His fingers were stained red. "Yep," he said laconically. He moved to the wall and rapped sharply on it, once, twice, three times. Then he turned back to her. "I am." "You killed Hodge," she said, remembering. "No," he shook his head. "I hurt him pretty badly, I think, but when I went back for the body, it was gone. He must have dragged himself away."
"He tore at his shoulder," she said. "I saw you."
"Yes, though it's worth noting that he was trying to kill you at the time. Did he hurt anyone else?" Clary sank her teeth into her lip. She tasted blood, but it was old blood from where Hugo had attacked her.
"Jace,"
she said in a whisper. Hodge knocked him out and handed him over to Valentine.
To Valentine? Luke said, looking astonished. I knew Hodge had given Valentine the mortal cup, but I hadn't realized.
How did you know that? Clary began before remembering. You heard me talking to Hodge in the alley, she said, before you jumped him.
I jumped him, as you put it, because he was about to slice your head off, Luke said, then looked up as the cell door opened again and a tall man came in, followed by a tiny woman, so short she looked like a child. Both of them wore plain casual clothes, jeans and cotton shirts, and both had the same untidy flyaway hair, though the woman's was fair and the man's was a badgery gray and black. Both had the same young old faces, unlined but with tired eyes.
Clary, said Luke, meet my second and third, Gretel and Alaric. Alaric inclined his massive head to her.
We have met.
Clary stared, alarmed.
Have we? At the Hotel du Mor, he said. You put your knife in my ribs.
She shrank against the wall. I'm sorry.
Don't be, he said. It was an excellent throw.
He slid a hand into his breast pocket and removed Jace's dagger with its winking red eye. He held it out to her.
I think this is yours.
Clary stared. But don't worry, he assured her. I cleaned the blade. Wordlessly, she took it. Luke was chuckling under his breath.
In retrospect, he said, perhaps the raid on the Du Mor was not as well planned as it might have been. I had set a group of my wolves to watch you and go after you if you seemed to be in any danger. When you went into the Du Mor,
Jace and I could have handled it. Clary slid the dagger into her belt. Gretel aimed a tolerant smile at her. Is that what you summoned us for, sir?
No, said Luke. He touched his side. My wounds opened up, and Clary here has some injuries of her own that could use a bit of tending, if you wouldn't mind getting the supplies.
Gretel inclined her head. I will return with the healing kit, she said and left, Alaric trailing her like an outsized shadow.
She called you sir, said Clary the moment the cell door closed behind them. And what do you mean by your second and third what?
In command, said Luke slowly. I am the leader of this particular wolf pack. That's why Gretel called me sir. Believe me, it took a fair bit of work to break her of the habit of calling me master.
Did my mother know?
Know what?
That you're a werewolf.
Yes, she's known since it happened.
Neither of you, of course, thought to mention this to me.
I would have told you, said Luke, but your mother was adamant that you know nothing of shadow hunters or the shadow world. I couldn't explain away my being a werewolf as some kind of isolated incident, Clary. It's all part of the larger pattern that your mother didn't want you to see. I don't know what you've learned.
A lot, Clary said flatly. I know my mother was a shadow hunter. I know she was married to Valentine and that she stole the mortal cup from him and went into hiding. I know that after she had me, she took me to Magnus Bane every 2 years to have my sight taken away. I know that when Valentine tried to get you to tell him where the cup was in exchange for my mom's life, you told him she didn't matter to you.
Luke stared at the wall. I didn't know where the cup was, he said. She'd never told me.
You could have tried to bargain. Valentine doesn't bargain. He never has. If the advantage isn't his, he won't even come to the table. He's entirely single-minded and totally without compassion, and though he may have loved your mother once, he wouldn't hesitate to kill her. No, I wasn't going to bargain with Valentine.
So you just decided to abandon her? Clary demanded furiously. You're the leader of a whole pack of werewolves, and you just decided she didn't even really need your help? You know, it was bad enough when I thought you were another shadow hunter and you turned your back on her because of some stupid shadow hunter vow or something. But now I know you're just a slimy downworlder who didn't even care that all those years she treated you like a friend, like an equal, and this is how you paid her back.
Listen to you, Luke said quietly. You sound like a Lightwood.
She narrowed her eyes.
Don't talk about Alec and Isabel like you know them.
I meant their parents, said Luke, whom I did know very well, in fact, when we were all shadow hunters together. She felt her lips part in surprise.
I knew you were in the circle, but how did you keep them from finding out you were a werewolf? Didn't they know?
No, said Luke, because I wasn't born a werewolf. I was made one. And I can already see that if you're going to be persuaded to listen to anything I have to say, you're going to have to hear the whole story. It's a long tale, but I think we have the time for it.
Part 3. The Descent Beckons. The descent beckons as the ascent beckoned. William Carlos Williams, The Descent. 21. The Werewolf's Tale. The truth is, I've known your mother since we were children. We grew up in Idris. It's a beautiful place, and I've always regretted that you've never seen it. You would love the glossy pines in winter, the dark earth and cold crystal rivers. There's a small network of towns and a single city, Alicante, where the clave meets. They call it the Glass City because its towers are shaped from the same demon-repelling substance as our steles. In the sunlight, they sparkle like glass. When Jocelyn and I were old enough, we were sent to Alicante to school. It was there I met Valentine. He was older than I was by a year, by far the most popular boy in school. He was handsome, clever, rich, dedicated, an incredible warrior. I was nothing, neither rich nor brilliant, from an unremarkable country family, and I struggled in my studies. Jocelyn was a natural shadow hunter. I was not. I could not bear the lightest marks or learn the simplest techniques. I thought sometimes about running away, returning home in shame. Even becoming a mundane, I was that miserable. It was Valentine who saved me. He came to my room. I'd never even thought he knew my name. He offered to train me. He said he knew that I was struggling, but he saw in me the seeds of a great shadow hunter. And under his tutelage, I did improve. I passed my exams, bore my first marks, killed my first demon. I worshipped him. I thought the sun rose and set on Valentine Morgenstern. I wasn't the only misfit he'd rescued, of course. There were others. Hodge Starkweather, who got along better with books than he did with people. Maris Trueblood, whose brother had married a mundane. Robert Lightwood, who was terrified of the marks. Valentine brought them all under his wing. I thought it was kindness then. Now I am not so sure. Now I think he was building himself a cult. Valentine was obsessed with the idea that in every generation there were fewer and fewer shadow hunters, that we were a dying breed. He was sure that if only the Clave would more freely use Raziel's cup, more shadow hunters could be made. To the teachers, this idea was sacrilege. It is not for just anyone to choose who can and cannot become a shadow hunter. Flippantly, Valentine would ask, "Why not make all men shadow hunters then? Why not gift them all with the ability to see the shadow world? Why keep that power selfishly to ourselves?" When the teachers answered that most humans cannot survive the transition, Valentine claimed they were lying, trying to keep the power of the Nephilim limited to an elite few. That was his claim at the time. Now I think he probably felt the collateral damage was worth the end result. In any case, he convinced our little group of his rightness. We formed the circle, with our stated intent being to save the race of shadow hunters from extinction. Of course, being 17, we weren't quite sure how we would do it, but we were sure we'd eventually accomplish something significant. Then came the night that Valentine's father was killed in a routine raid on a werewolf encampment. When Valentine returned to school after the funeral, he wore the red marks of mourning. He was different in other ways. His kindness was now interspersed with flashes of rage that bordered on cruelty. I put this new behavior down to grief and tried harder than ever to please him. I never answered his anger with anger of my own. I felt only the sick sense that I disappointed him. The only one that could calm his rages was your mother. She had always stood a little apart from our group,
sometimes mockingly calling us Valentine's fan club. That changed when his father died. His pain awakened her sympathy. They fell in love. I loved him too. He was my closest friend, and I was happy to see Jocelyn with him. When we left school, they married and went to live on her family's estate. I also returned home, but the circle continued. It had started as a sort of school adventure, but it grew in scale and power, and Valentine grew with it. Its ideals had changed as well. The circle still clamored for the mortal cup, but since the death of his father, Valentine had become an outspoken proponent of war against all downworlders, not just those who broke the accords. This world was for humans, he argued, not part demons. Demons could never be fully trusted. I was uncomfortable with the circle's new direction, but I stuck with it, partly because I still couldn't bear to let Valentine down, partly because Jocelyn had asked me to continue. She had some hope that I would be able to bring moderation to the circle, but that was impossible. There was no moderating Valentine, and Robert and Maris Lightwood, now married, were almost as bad. Only Michael Wayland was unsure, as I was, but despite our reluctance, we followed still. As a group, we hunted downworlders tirelessly, seeking those who had committed even the slightest infraction. Valentine never killed a creature who had not broken the accords, but he did other things. I saw him fasten silver coins to the eyelids of a werewolf child, blinding her, in an attempt to get the girl to tell him where her brother was. I saw him, but you don't need to hear this. No, I'm sorry. What happened next was that Jocelyn became pregnant. The day she told me that, she also confessed that she had grown afraid of her husband. His behavior had turned weird, erratic. He would disappear into their cellars for nights at a time. Sometimes she would hear screams through the walls. I went to him. He laughed, dismissing her fears as the jitters of a woman carrying her first child. He invited me to hunt with him that night. We were still trying to clean out the nest of werewolves who had killed his father years before. We were parabatai, a perfect hunting team of two, warriors who would die for each other. So when Valentine told me he would guard my back that night, I believed him. I didn't see the wolf until it was on me. I remember its teeth fastened on my shoulder and nothing else of that night. When I awoke, I was lying in Valentine's house, my shoulder bandaged, and Jocelyn was there. Not all werewolf bites result in lycanthropy. I healed of the injury and passed the next few weeks in a torment of waiting. Waiting for the full moon. The Clave would have locked me in an observation cell had they known, but Valentine and Jocelyn kept silent. 3 weeks later, the moon rose full and bright, and I began to change. The first change is always the hardest. I remember a bewilderment of agony, a blackness, and waking up hours later in a meadow miles from the city. I was covered in blood, the torn body of some small woodland animal at my feet. I made my way back to the manor, and they met me at the door. Jocelyn fell on me, weeping, but Valentine pulled her away. I stood bloody and shaking on my feet. I could scarcely think, and the taste of raw meat was still in my mouth. I don't know what I had expected, but I suppose I should have known. Valentine dragged me down the steps and into the woods with him. He told me that he ought to kill me himself, but seeing me then, he could not bring himself to do it. He gave me a dagger that had once belonged to his father. He said I should do the honorable thing and end my own life. He kissed the dagger when he handed it to me and went back inside the manor house and barred the door. I ran through the night, sometimes as a man, sometimes as a wolf, until I crossed the border. I burst into the midst of the werewolf encampment, brandishing my dagger, and demanded to meet in combat the lycanthrope who'd bitten me and turned me into one of them. Laughing, they pointed me toward the clan leader. Hands and teeth still bloody from the hunt, he rose to face me. I'd never been much for a single combat. The crossbow was my weapon. I had excellent sight and aim. But I had never been very good at close range. It was Valentine who was skilled in fighting hand to hand. But I wanted only to die and to take with me the creature who had ruined me.
I suppose I thought if I could avenge myself and kill the wolves who had murdered his father, Valentine would mourn me. As we grappled, sometimes as men, sometimes as wolves, I saw that he was surprised by my fierceness. As the night faded into day, he began to tire, but my rage never abated. And as the sun began to set again, I sank my dagger into his neck and he died, soaking me with his blood. I expected the pack to set on me and tear me apart, but they knelt at my feet and bared their throats in submission. The wolves have a law. Whoever kills the clan leader takes his place. I had come to the place of the wolves, and instead of finding death and vengeance there, I found a new life. I left behind my old self and almost forgot what it was like to be a shadow hunter. But I did not forget Jocelyn. The thought of her was a constant companion. I feared for her in the company of Valentine, but I knew that if I came near the manor house, the circle would hunt me down and kill me. In the end, she came to me. I was asleep in the camp when my second-in-command came to tell me that there was a young shadow hunter woman waiting to see me. I knew immediately who it must be. I could see the disapproval in his eyes as I raced to meet her. They all knew I had once been a shadow hunter, of course, but it was considered a shameful secret never spoken of. Valentine would have laughed. She was waiting for me just outside the encampment. She was no longer pregnant and looked drawn and pale. She had had her child, she said, a boy, and had named him Jonathan Christopher. She cried when she saw me. She was angry that I had not let her know I was still alive. Valentine had told the circle I had taken my own life, but she had not believed it. She knew that I would never do such a thing. I felt her faith in me was unwarranted, but I was so relieved to see her again that I didn't contradict her. I asked her how she had found me. She said that there were rumors in Alicante of a werewolf who had once been a shadow hunter. Valentine had heard the rumors too, and she had ridden to warn me. He came soon after, but I hid from him, as werewolves can, and he left without bloodshed. After that, I began to meet Jocelyn in secret. It was the year of the Accords, and all of Downworld was abuzz with them and Valentine's probable plans for disrupting them. I heard that he had argued passionately in the Clave against the Accords, but with no success. So the Circle made a new plan, steeped in secrecy. They allied themselves with demons, the greatest enemies of shadow hunters, in order to procure weapons that could be smuggled undetected into the Great Hall of the Angel, where the Accords would be signed. And with the aid of a demon, Valentine stole the mortal cup. He left in its place a facsimile. It was months before the Clave realized the cup was missing, and by then it was too late. Jocelyn tried to learn what Valentine intended to do with the cup, but could not. But she knew that the Circle planned to fall upon the unarmed Downworlders and murder them in the hall. After such wholesale slaughter, the Accords would fail. Despite the chaos, in a strange way, those were happy days. Jocelyn and I sent messages covertly to the fairies, the warlocks, and even to those age-old enemies of wolfkind, the vampires, warning them of Valentine's plans and bidding them prepare for battle. We worked together, werewolf and Nephilim. On the day of the Accords, I watched from a hidden place as Jocelyn and Valentine left the manor house. I remember how she bent to kiss the white blonde head of her son. I remember the way the sun shone on her hair. I remember her smile. They rode into Alicante by carriage. I followed, running on 4 feet, and my pack ran with me. The Great Hall of the Angel was crowded with all the assembled Clave and score upon score of Downworlders. When the Accords were presented for signing, Valentine rose to his feet and the Circle rose with him, sweeping back their cloaks to lift their weapons. As the hall exploded into chaos, Jocelyn ran to the great double doors of the hall and flung them open. My pack were the first at the door. We burst into the hall, tearing the night with our howls, and we were followed by fairy knights with weapons of glass and twisted thorns. After them came the night children, with bared fangs and warlocks wielding flame and iron. As the panicked masses fled the hall, we fell upon the members of the Circle. Never had the Hall of the Angel seen such bloodshed. We tried not to harm those shadow hunters who were not of the Circle. Jocelyn marked them out, one by one, with a warlock's spell.
but many died, and I fear we were responsible for some. Certainly, afterward, we were blamed for many. As for the Circle, there were far more of them than we had imagined, and they clashed fiercely with the Downworlders. I fought through the crowd to Valentine. My only thought had been of him, that I might be the one to kill him, that I might have that honor. I found him at last by the great statue of the angel, dispatching a fairy knight with the broad stroke of his blood-stained dagger. When he saw me, he smiled, fierce and feral. "A werewolf who fights with a sword and dagger," he said, "is as unnatural as a dog who eats with a fork and a knife." "You know the sword, you know the dagger," I said, "and you know who I am. If you must address me, use my name." "I do not know the names of half-men," said Valentine. "Once I had a friend, a man of honor who would have died before he let his blood be polluted. Now a nameless monster with his face stands before me." He raised his blade. "I should have killed you while I had the chance," he cried, and lunged for me. I parried the blow, and we fought up and down the dais while the battle raged around us, and one by one the members of the Circle fell. I saw the Lightwoods drop their weapons and flee. Hodge was already gone, having fled at the outset. And then I saw Jocelyn racing up the stairs toward me, her face a mask of fear. "Valentine, stop," she cried out. "This is Luke, your friend, almost your brother." With a snarl, Valentine seized her and dragged her in front of him, his dagger to her throat. I dropped my blade. I would not risk his harming her. He saw what was in my eyes. "You always wanted her," he hissed. "And now the two of you have plotted my betrayal together. You will regret what you have done all the rest of your lives." With that, he snatched the locket from Jocelyn's throat and hurled it at me. The silver cord burned me like a lash. I screamed and fell back, and in that moment he vanished into the melee, dragging her with him. I followed, burned and bleeding, but he was too fast, cutting a path through the thick of the crowd and over the dead. I staggered out into the moonlight. The hall was burning and the sky was lit with fire. I could see all down the green lawns of the capital to the dark river and the road along the riverbank where people were fleeing into the night. I found Jocelyn by the banks of the river at last. Valentine was gone, and she was terrified for Jonathan, desperate to get home. We found a horse, and she plunged away. Dropping into wolf form, I followed at her heels. Wolves are fast, but a rested horse is faster. I fell far behind, and she arrived at the manor house before I did. I knew, even as I neared the house, that something was terribly wrong. Here, too, the smell of fire hung heavy in the air, and there was something overlaying it, something thick and sweet, the stench of demonic witchcraft. I became a man again as I limped up the long drive, white in the moonlight, like a river of silver leading to ruins. For the manor house had been reduced to ashes. Layer upon layer of sifting whiteness strewn across the lawns by the night wind. Only the foundations, like burned bones, were still visible. Here a window, there a leaning chimney. But the substance of the house, the bricks and the mortar, the priceless books and ancient tapestries handed down through generations of shadow hunters, were dust blowing across the face of the moon. Valentine had destroyed the house with demon fire. He must have. No fire of this world burns so hot nor leaves so little behind. I made my way into the still smoldering ruins. I found Jocelyn kneeling on what had perhaps once been the front doorsteps. They were blackened by fire. And there were bones, charred to blackness but recognizably human, with scraps of cloth here and there and bits of jewelry the fire had not taken. Red and gold threads still clung to the bones of Jocelyn's mother, and the heat had melted her father's dagger to his skeletal hand. Among another pile of bones gleamed Valentine's silver amulet, with the insignia of the Circle still burning white-hot upon its face, and among the remains, scattered as if they were too fragile to hold together, were the bones of a child. "You will regret what you have done," Valentine had said. And
As I knelt with Jocelyn on the burned paving stones, I knew that he was right. I did regret it, and have regretted it every day since. We rode back through the city that night among the still-burning fires and shrieking people, and then out into the darkness of the country. It was a week before Jocelyn spoke again. I took her out of Idris. We fled to Paris. We had no money, but she refused to go to the institute there and ask for help. She was done with shadow hunters, she told me. Done with the shadow world. I sat in the tiny, cheap hotel room we had rented and tried to reason with her, but it did no good. She was obstinate. At last, she told me why. She was carrying another child and had known it for weeks. She would make a new life for herself and her baby, and she wanted no whisper of clave or covenant ever to taint her future. She showed me the amulet she had taken from the pile of bones. In the flea market at Clignancourt, she sold it, and with that money purchased an airplane ticket. She wouldn't tell me where she was going. The farther away she could get from Idris, she said, the better. I knew that leaving her old life behind meant leaving me behind as well, and I argued with her, but to no avail. I knew that if not for the child she carried, she would have taken her own life. And since to lose her to the mundane world was better than to lose her to death, I at last reluctantly agreed to her plan. And so it was that I bid her goodbye at the airport. The last words Jocelyn spoke to me in that dreary departure hall chilled me to the bone. Valentine is not dead. After she was gone, I returned to my pack, but I found no peace there. Always there was a hollow aching inside me, and always I woke up with her name unspoken on my lips. I was not the leader I had once been, I knew that much. I was just and fair, but remote. I could not find friends among the wolf people, nor a mate. I was, in the end, too much human, too much shadow hunter, to be at rest among the lycanthropes. I hunted, but the hunt brought no satisfaction, and when it came time for the accords to be signed at last, I went into the city to sign them. In the Hall of the Angel, scrubbed free of blood, the shadow hunters and the four branches of half-humans sat down again to sign the papers that would bring peace among us. I was astonished to see the Lightwoods, who seemed equally astonished that I wasn't dead. They themselves, they said, along with Hodge Starkweather and Michael Wayland, were the only members of the former circle to have escaped death that night in the hall. Michael, racked with grief over the loss of his wife, had hidden himself away at his country estate with his young son. The Clave had punished the other three with exile. They were leaving for New York to run the institute there. The Lightwoods, who had connections to the highest families in the Clave, got off with a far lighter sentence than Hodge. A curse had been laid on him. He would go with them, but if ever he were to leave the hallowed ground of the Institute, he would be instantly slain. He was devoting himself to his studies, they said, and would make a fine tutor for their children. When we signed the accords, I rose from my chair and went from the hall down to the river where I'd found Jocelyn on the night of the uprising. Watching the dark waters flow, I knew I could never find peace in my homeland. I had to be with her or nowhere at all. I determined to look for her. I left my pack, naming another in my stead. I think they were relieved to see me go. I traveled as the wolf without a pack travels, alone, at night, keeping to the byways and country roads. I went back to Paris, but found no clue there. Then I went to London. From London, I took a boat to Boston. I stayed a while in the cities, then in the White Mountains of the frozen north. I traveled a good deal, but more and more I found myself thinking of New York and the exiled shadow hunters there. Jocelyn, in a way, was an exile too. At length, I arrived in New York with a single duffel bag and no idea where to look for your mother. It would have been easy enough for me to find a wolf pack and join it, but I resisted. As I had done in other cities, I sent out messages through Downworld, searching for any sign of Jocelyn, but there was nothing, no word at all, as if she had simply disappeared into the mundane world without a trace. I began to despair. In the end, I found her by chance. I was prowling the streets of Soho randomly.
As I stood on the cobblestones of Broome Street, a painting hanging in a gallery window caught my eye. It was the study of a landscape I recognized immediately. The view from the windows of her family's manor house, the green lawns sweeping down to the line of trees that hid the road beyond. I recognized her style, her brushwork, everything. I banged on the door of the gallery, but it was closed and locked. I returned to the painting, and this time I saw the signature. It was the first time I had seen her new name, Jocelyn Frey. By that evening, I had found her living in a fifth-floor walk-up in that artist's haven, the East Village. I walked up the grimy, half-lit stairs with my heart in my throat and knocked on her door. It was opened by a little girl with dark red braids and inquisitive eyes. And then, behind her, I saw Jocelyn walking toward me, her hands stained with paint, and her face just the same as it had been when we were children. The rest you know.
This ends Disc 10. City of Bones, Disc 11.
22. Renwick's Ruin. For a long moment after Luke finished speaking, there was silence in the room. The only sound was the faint drip of water down the stone walls. Finally, he said, "Say something, Clary."
"What do you want me to say?"
He sighed. "Maybe that you understand?" Clary could hear the blood pounding in her ears. She felt as if her life had been built on a sheet of ice as thin as paper, and now the ice was beginning to crack, threatening to plunge her into the icy darkness below. Down into the dark water, she thought, where all her mother's secrets drifted in the currents, the forgotten remains of a shipwrecked life. She looked up at Luke. He seemed wavering, indistinct, as if she looked through a blurred glass. "My father," she said. "That picture my mother always kept on the mantle?"
"That wasn't your father," said Luke.
"Did he ever even exist?" Clary's voice rose. "Was there ever a John Clark, or did my mother make him up too?"
"John Clark existed, but he wasn't your father. He was the son of two of your mother's neighbors when you lived in the East Village. He died in a car crash, just like your mother told you, but she never knew him. She had his photo because the neighbors commissioned her to paint a portrait of him in his army uniform. She gave them the portrait but kept the photo and pretended the man in it had been your father. I think she thought it was easier that way. After all, if she'd claimed he'd run off or disappeared, you'd have wanted to look for him. A dead man won't contradict your lies," Clary finished for him bitterly. "Didn't she think it was wrong? All those years letting me think my father was dead when my real father..." Luke said nothing, letting her find the end of the sentence herself, letting her think the unthinkable thought on her own.
"Is Valentine..." Her voice shook. "That's what you're telling me, right? That Valentine was... is my father?"
Luke nodded, his knotted fingers the only sign of the tension he felt. "Yes."
"Oh my God!" Clary leaped to her feet, no longer able to sit still. She paced to the bars of the cell. "That's not possible. It's just not possible. Clary, please don't get upset. Don't get upset! You're telling me that my dad is a guy who's basically an evil overlord, and you want me to not get upset?"
"He wasn't evil to begin with," Luke said, sounding almost apologetic.
"Oh, I beg to differ. I think he was clearly evil. All that stuff he was spouting about keeping the human race pure and the importance of untainted blood, he was like one of those creepy white power guys, and you two totally fell for it."
"I wasn't the one talking about slimy downworlders just minutes ago," Luke said quietly. "Or about how they couldn't be trusted."
"That's not the same thing."
Clary could hear the tears in her voice.
"I had a brother," she went on, her voice catching. "Grandparents, too. They're dead?"
Luke nodded, looking down at his big hands open on his knees. "They're dead."
"Jonathan," she said softly. "He would have been older than me. A year older?" Luke said nothing.
I always wanted a brother, she said.
Don't, he said wretchedly. Don't torture yourself. You can see why your mother kept all this from you, can't you? What good would it have done you to know what you had lost before you were even born? That box, Clary said, her mind working feverishly. With the JC on it. Jonathan Christopher. That's what she was always crying over. That was his lock of hair. My brother's, not my father's.
Yes.
And when you said, Clary isn't Jonathan, you meant my brother. My mom was so overprotective of me because she'd already had one child who died.
Before Luke could reply, the cell door clanged open and Gretel entered. The healing kit, which Clary had been envisioning as a hard, plastic-sided box with the Red Cross insignia on it, turned out to be a big wooden tray stacked with folded bandages, steaming bowls of unidentified liquids, and herbs that gave off a pungent, lemony odor. Gretel set the tray down beside the cot and gestured for Clary to sit down, which she did unwillingly.
That's a good girl, said the wolf woman, dipping a cloth into one of the bowls and lifting it to Clary's face.
Gently, she cleaned away the dried blood.
What happened to you? She asked disapprovingly, as if she suspected Clary of taking a cheese grater to her face.
I was wondering that myself, said Luke, watching the goings-on with folded arms. Hugo attacked me. Clary tried not to wince as the astringent liquid stung her wounds.
Hugo?
Luke blinked.
Hodge's bird. I think it was his bird, anyway. Maybe it was Valentine's.
Hugin, Luke said softly. Hugin and Munin were Valentine's pet birds. Their names mean